Okay, let's begin. Bishitchem. Just a few weeks ago, there was a New York Times front page story about a lawyer from New York who filed a legal brief on behalf of his client in a personal injury case and used ChatGPT, this popular artificial intelligence chatbot, which is a large language model that can do all sorts of incredible things. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to play around with it, but you can ask it questions, and it will answer your questions on any topic. It can write computer programs or fix or edit computer programs for computer programmers. It knows all sorts of computer programming languages. It can write articles and essays for you. If my 12-year-old has an assignment on a specific book, he's writing a book report, he can type in, please, you know, write me a 1,000-page essay on this particular book. It can compose poetry, you can give it a topic, it can compose music, and it can even answer questions of halakha. And so it provided this lawyer, you can imagine how much time it saved him, it provided him with all sorts of precedents and cases to be able to cite. And the only problem was that the precedents and the cases were all made up. They were completely fictitious. Lo haya velo nivra. And so obviously this lawyer was humiliated and he apologized, but now the judge is considering sanctions and he may very well lose his license to practice law. But this story raises real questions, all sorts of ethical dilemmas and questions. And by the way, currently there are a whole host of lawsuits against the developers of these chatbots and these artificial intelligence programs. But just one question I've been thinking about, especially with my kids, what will this mean for education? Right? When we were young, we used to have to go to a thing called a library, if you remember what libraries were, and we used to have to go through a card catalog, if you remember what those were. And then we'd have to take out books, if you can remember what books were. And you'd have to cite your sources, and you'd have to do your research. And if you wanted to cheat back then, you'd have to cheat from a friend. Okay? Today, even my kids, before the appearance of these chatbots, could just Google it, right? They could just look on Wikipedia and cut and paste, but at least there you had hopefully some sources, some citations. And the truth is, a teacher or a professor with a quick search could easily determine whether this report, this essay, this assignment was original or it was just downloaded off the internet. It was just cut and pasted. But today, with these chatbots, you can create something yesh me'ayin, a whole research paper. So what is education going to look like in the near future? And then, of course, art and music and culture, because you can have artificial intelligence create a piece of art for you. Right? You can have it make a painting for you. It can generate music. And it's very good at mimicking. So you can ask it, let's say, to, you know, I don't know, paint a picture of the Beit HaMikdash in the style of Picasso. Or, you know, write a poem, Ichveis, about the Beit HaMikdash, you know, in the style of, whatever, Robert Frost. Okay, two paths converged, and I took the one on the way to the Holy Temple. You can have it create a piece of music for you, let's say, about the Beit HaMikdash in the style of the Beatles. And it's really incredible. And you can even have it create a Dvar Torah for you, in the style, as I've seen some rabbis post already on the internet, in the style of, let's say, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Okay? And what about job security? I'll take questions at the end. What about job security? Right? Computer programmers are biting their nails because this may threaten their entire occupation, their parnassa, and graphic designers and people involved in technical writing or editing. You know, all of a sudden, the artificial intelligence, the chatbot, can edit the article better than you can. It's better. It knows more laws of grammar better than you do, right? And there's currently a screenwriter strike going on in Los Angeles. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I came back from Los Angeles right before Shavuot. I was there speaking. And for weeks, there's been a strike, and they're demanding more pay. But one of the issues involved is, how is artificial intelligence going to perhaps threaten their jobs? Do they have job security? Because with artificial intelligence, you can create a script. You can write a script for a movie or for television, okay? And this is not unlike how the Industrial Revolution replaced human beings with machines and automation and made many jobs obsolete. So will the technical revolution or the artificial intelligence revolution make us obsolete? And what about us rabbis? And so the question that I'd like to explore together with you this morning is, will robots replace rabbis? And I'd like to look at the role of artificial intelligence on Psak Halacha. Will we need rabbis in the future? Will you need to ask a shaila, a halachic question, a sheila hilchatit to a rabbi, or will you just be able to consult the artificial intelligence and maybe get a better answer? So currently, when you ask a question of halacha to a chatbot like ChatGPT, and Google just released its chatbot, there are others out there as well, and this is constantly growing and expanding and getting better, so the chatbot, at least ChatGPT, without explaining the reason or the rationale behind the ruling, will often give you somewhat of an answer and then conclude that one should consult a competent authority. And if you look at the very top of your source sheets, I included a question that I posed to ChatGPT and the answer it gave. And this is based on the topic that we've been discussing over the past few weeks, the use of electricity on Shabbat. And so I asked, is it permitted to use electricity on Shabbat? And so ChatGPT gave its answer, and you can read the answer that it gave, that Orthodox Judaism generally prohibits the operation of electrical devices due to the prohibition of kindling a fire. Well, as we explored over the past few weeks, it's not so simple. Not all poskim consider it an isur of havarat eish. Some consider it maybe an isur of boneh, makeh bepatish, maybe molid, an isur derabanan of makeh bepatish, or maybe uvdin dechol, or, you know, different reasons that the poskim gave in their approach to the use of electricity on Shabbat. And then it talks about conservative and reform Judaism. It has to be democratic and egalitarian. And then finally, if you look at the last paragraph, this is great. It's important to note that the above information provides a general overview, and specific practices may differ among individuals and communities. If you have specific questions regarding the practices and rulings of a particular Jewish community or authority, it is advisable to consult with a knowledgeable rabbi or religious leader. Very democratic. Basically, in sum, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Okay? So, and it learns, and it's been programmed, and it's been taught, and I've played around with it, and the truth is it's not without mistakes. Sometimes it will cite opinions that don't exist or incorrect or misleading information, not unlike in the case of this New York attorney. But these large language models learn. And there's already ChatGPT version 4, which you have to subscribe to and pay for, but it's already much better, supposedly, than the free version, which I've been using, ChatGPT version 3.5, which is available for free, and I encourage all of you to experiment and play around with it. So, how do we approach this question of artificial intelligence and psak halacha? Will these chatbots replace rabbis? So, first of all, some she'elot aren't she'elot. In other words, there are some questions that are so basic, that are so simple, you need not go to a posek, to a rabbi, to ask these questions. You can just open up a Shulchan Aruch, you can open up an art scroll book, or you can Google it, you can consult Rabbi Google. What if you, in the morning, making your coffee, took a meat spoon and mixed it into your hot coffee with milk, what do you do? So some questions are so basic, you know, you need not pose them to a rabbi, and maybe Google or ChatGPT can provide you with an answer, so long as the answer is correct and accurate, and obviously you'd have to verify that. Now, with Rabbi Google, when Google would point you to a website, and you know, oftentimes if you do a search on a Jewish topic, a Torah topic, it will often take you to the two largest Jewish websites, Esh HaTorah and Chabad.org. So there, at least you can see who authored the article. There's some accountability. There's some responsibility behind the Psak Halacha. Okay, with artificial intelligence, again, it makes things a little more difficult. Although, as I've said, when I've played around with it, it will sometimes cite different poskim. The problem is right now it makes mistakes, but in the future it's going to get only better. And it reminds me of how very early on, when they started developing these databases like the Bar Ilan Responsa project and include all of these tshuvot, all of these responsa, and they posed a question to the Bar Ilan Responsa or maybe one of the other early databases and search engines, and they posed the same question to Rav Avadia Yosef, the Posek Hador, and Rav Avadia was able to cite more tshuvot. Right? He beat the computer. But that was early on, and as, again, these technologies advance, I'm sure it has gotten better. But the question is it enough just to be able to access that information, to have access to, let's say, the entire corpus of Jewish literature, to the entire Talmud's Bavli and Yerushalmi, and to all of the Rishonim, and to all of the codes of Jewish law, the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, and all sorts of the Nosei Kalim, the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, and the Tshuvot of Rav Avadia, and the Tshuvot of Rav Moshe. Is that enough? Or is Psak something that oftentimes requires more than just access to the information, but the knowledge and really the seichel to apply the information? And oftentimes, it's not enough just to be able to access the information, but you need to understand the context and interpret the information. We discussed last week Grama on Shabbat, Gram Kibui. And we didn't get into all of the minutia of the discussion, but a lot of the machloket, a lot of the debates about Grama today has to do with how to really understand the parameters of Grama, and do we compare Grama on Shabbat, Gram Kibui, extinguishing a flame indirectly, which is what the Mishnah and the Gemara presents, to, for instance, Grama when it comes to damages, and Grama when it comes to murder, other cases of Grama in the Talmud, or no, are they different? So that, again, requires an understanding of context. And sometimes, poskim will even apply a passage in the Talmud, which lichora, and you see Rav Moshe Feinstein does this often, maybe it's a passage in the Agadah, which lichora has nothing to do with the matter at hand, nothing to do with the question that he's being asked, but he takes a passage in the Gemara, and he interprets it maybe out of its context and shows how, no, indeed it is related to this question. And so that, I don't know if a chatbot, at least right now, is capable of doing so. Maybe in the future, as it continues to learn and get smarter, it will be able to understand context and interpret things out of context and apply them. But I have my doubts and hesitations if a language model will be able to do that. But again, if it's constantly learning, maybe it will. But what I'd like to suggest, and I'd like to suggest a number of things this morning as to why I think artificial intelligence will never replace the posek. And we will always need poskim. And Baruch Hashem, we rabbis will not be out of a job. Psak is very personal. Right? As I said, it's not enough to have access to information. You have to know how to apply it to the situation. You need to know how to interpret it, to understand it in its context, maybe understand it out of its context too. But you need to know how to apply it to the situation. Psak is, it's not one size fits all. Psak halacha is not cookie cutter. And so if you take a look at source number one, this is a very short tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein, from the Igrot Moshe, Yoredei Achelik Gimel, where he writes that he's very upset that he heard there are those who are translating his tshuvot into English. And he says, first of all, when you translate something, things always get lost in translation. So take a look where I've underlined. He writes, Shamati shechad asas sefer bilaz. I heard that someone put out a book in English. V'hatakad dinim me'ha sefer yigod Moshe sheli. And he recorded some of the halachot, some of the piskei
din piskei halacha from my work igrot Moshe from my tshuvot v'hu isur, and this is a prohibition. This is prohibited. Af im haya hatargum ra'ui shebizmanenu leika mishiachol lomar ulahadpis psakim below biur umekorot ukvar bikesh mene reshut eze in shei mikan v'amarti she'eni noten reshut al ze. He says, even let's say if the translation is accurate, is authentic, is good, okay? Nevertheless, you can't just publish the final say, the conclusions, the psak halacha, without the explanation. So he's upset how people were translating his tshuvot and merely summarizing them without all the svarot, without all the logic behind. I mean, the brilliance of Rav Moshe's tshuvot is in the way he understands the question and the way he applies sources to the question. As I mentioned, sometimes he takes sources which, lichora, you'd think have nothing to do with the question. But you see how adept he was at adapting those sources. So that's number one. Even if it's a faithful translation, but you can't leave out all of the svarot, all of the explanations behind it, all of the sources. And then he writes, the gamnid sa shelo hetik karui v'yesh kamadvarim b'tautim, the kamadvarim shegormim litot, sheze od garua biyoter. And he said, and sometimes it might not be a faithful translation, and you find mistakes, and that's even worse. And then this is crucial, this last line where I've underlined, v'gam la'atik ha'tshuvot mamash pashut, shu chisaron gadol, li'tein ha'psakim li'inshei d'alma, she'enem talmidei chachamim she'avo l'damot milta l'milta. And even to copy the piskei halacha, the final rulings, and to make them available to the amei ha'aretz, he writes, this is a great danger. Why? Because people who are not talmidei chachamim, if you tell them, oh, Rav Moshe ruled X in such a case, they are going to take certain liberties. She'avo lidamot milta lemilta. They're going to make comparisons. They're going to compare one case to another. And psak is very personal. And Rav Moshe writes about this a number of times in the Igrot Moshe, right? That he published these tshuvot so people can learn from them. But you can't apply a tshuva that he writes to a specific individual to every single case. You can't apply it too broadly. There's a danger in that because Pesach is very personal. And there are many stories about Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rav Moshe Feinstein himself and many others who, you know, the story is told that some lady comes in to the shul or the Rav's home on a Friday afternoon with a chicken that was just shechted, and she has a question whether that chicken is kosher or not. And Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, or Rav Moshe Feinstein, or, you know, fill in the name, says to the lady, I'm sorry, it's not kosher, your chicken is treif. Okay. And then another lady comes in with a chicken with the very same problem. The posek, whether it's Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank or Rav Moshe, looks at it and says, it's mutar, it's permitted. So the Talmud asks, I don't understand. What's the difference? In the first case, you said it was treif. The second case, you said it was kosher. You said it was mutar. I don't understand. And the answer is, the first case, you saw the way the lady dressed. You know where she's from. She can afford to throw out the chicken, and we can be machmir. We can be stringent in such a case. But the second lady is very poor. If I aser, if I prohibit her chicken, she will not have what to eat over Shabbat. Okay? So Pesach is very personal, and the way that I once heard the story, at least attributed to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, that when he had to aser a chicken on an Erev Shabbat, he would take the money out of his own pocket and compensate the person because he didn't want them to feel that somehow, you know, the Torah, that halacha is somehow taking away the food from their table, taking food off their table. And in addition to the highly personal nature of Pesach and how, you know, even if the chatbot has access to all of Shas and Poskim, but again, it can never really be able to answer the individual because it's missing that humanity. It's also missing emotional intelligence. It's not just that psak is personal, but the posek has to feel for the individual. As I said in the story about Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rav Moshe, how they understood the case, but they also understood the individual, and that requires some emotional intelligence. There's a wonderful article that was published in 1999 by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in Tradition, titled The Human and Social Factor in Halacha. And it was based on a paper that he delivered at the Orthodox Forum, where he makes the point that while many would like to think that the nature of psak is such that it's completely objective and unbiased and completely based on halacha yevesha, the dry halacha, it's impossible to completely separate the psak from the posek. And there is an element of subjectivity even in psak. There is that human factor. And among the examples he gives, he cites two tshuvot here in sources number 2 and 3. Now, source number 2 is a tshuva from Masat Binyamin, and that is a work, those are the tshuvot of Rav Binyamin Aaron Selnik, very prominent Polish posek who lived from 1530 to 1620, and a big Rav in Poland, and Av Beitin, he was on the Vad Arba Artsot. Okay, among his Talmidim was the Ramah, and the Maharshal, and the Marami Lublin. So, he's dealing with a very personal issue. He's dealing with the question of whether a blind person can get an aliyah, can receive an aliyah, can be called up to the Torah. The Beit Yosef, both in his Beit Yosef and his Shulchan Aruch, argues that a blind person cannot receive an aliyah. Why? The individual being called up to the Torah to make the blessing on the Torah to receive an aliyah really should be reading from the Torah, except that being that many people are not educated. So we have the Baal Koreh, the Shliach Tzibur, stand in and read for the individual. But really the one making the blessing on the Torah should be reading from the Torah. And that's why the one who receives the Aliyah reads in an undertone. Now the Torah must be read by a sighted person because it has to be read from the text. You can't read the Torah, even if you're the biggest genius, the biggest Talmud Chacham, you can't lain by heart. You have to read from the Torah. So if the individual who receives the Aliyah is supposed to be reading, and it's as if he's reading, and the Baal Koreh is merely standing in his place, so then maybe, argues the Beit Yosef, it should be prohibited for a visual impaired, someone who's visually impaired, to receive an Aliyah. The Ramah and others are lenient and allow for it. But that's a question. By the way, it's a similar question by someone who is unable to read, someone who's completely illiterate. So, as I said, this is a very personal question for the Masad Binyamin here in source number 2, Rav Binyamin Aaron Selnik, because he, in his old age, had begun to lose his sight. And so he writes the following. And if you take a look at the bottom, it's this is the introduction to his tshuva, and it's pure poetry. It's quite amazing. He writes it in this rhyme. He writes, Kiza ata le'et ziknati chashchu haraot ba'arubot v'tchehena einai meraot. Because of my old age, my eyes are becoming dim, and I'm losing my sight. Okay, and then he basically continues and says, you know, why should it be that I, because of the loss of my sight, should be banished from sharing in Hashem's inheritance, which is the Torah? And why should I lose the opportunity to get an aliyah and to make a blessing on the Torah? And so just take a look at the very end where I've underlined. I'm just skipping for the sake of time, but he writes again, this is in poem form, the introduction is in a rhyme scheme. Ve'eftach bidvar halacha, so I'm going to open and begin. He asks, by the way, that Hashem should open up his eyes and give him light and sight to be able to answer this question. And he says, Ve'eftach bidvar halacha lirot al ma'asali harav kacha. I'm going to open with a matter of halacha in order to see what this rabbi did to me. Lirot al ma'asali harav kacha. He's addressing the Beit Yosef here, and then he continues with his svara, his reasoning why he believes it's permitted. So you see that sometimes Psak is very personal, right? You could argue, wait a minute, he's Nogea Badover. He has his own interessim and agenda. Why should he be permitted to answer such a question, right? But the answer is because there is an element of subjectivity. It's not purely objective. It's not purely dry halacha. And in source number 3, this is a tshuva from Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the great Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the Talmud Mufak of the Vilna Gaon. It's from the Chut HaMishulash, the Tshuvot Chut HaMishulash, which includes his tshuvot and two other Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhiner Yeshiva. That's why it's called Chut HaMishulash. And here, he's addressing a posek who is being machmir concerning freeing an aguna, a chained woman. A woman who either, an aguna can be a woman who is waiting for her husband to give a divorce. So the classic case of an aguna is where the husband is missing. And there's a mitzvah lahatir agunot. And we want to free women. And, you know, the tradition is that posts can roll up their sleeves and by the sweat of their brow do everything in their capacity to try to allow a woman to remarry. So he writes the following, V'ra'iti sheberov dvareinu kavanatenu holich el makom echad ela shekvod torato araba note el hachumra machmat she'en hadavar mutal alav. Wow. He says, I notice that you are being machmir because maybe you somehow don't feel the burden. V'afanik mohu lo paniti el tzdidei heterim ha'olim mitoch ha'iyun terem hu'ala ale ol ha'hora'a. So he says, and me, you may feel that the matter is not yours, you are not involved in it, you don't feel a sense of responsibility, but I feel a sense of responsibility. Initially, maybe I didn't, but now that the matter has been thrust upon me, I feel a tremendous sense of weight on my shoulders, a yoke. Okay. V'hein atasha, b'vonotenu harabim b'sivotenu, nitayem ador mechachamim, v'alu al tzavarei ol ha'hora'a mikol ha'sviva she'ena matirim b'shum ofen bilte haskama da'ati hakala. וחשבתי, אם קוני וראיתי, חובה לעצמי להתחזק בכל כוחי לשקוד על תקנת אגונות, והשם יתברך יצילני משגיאות. So he says that, you know, maybe initially I also did not feel a sense of responsibility and didn't want to be mekil, but now, since due to our many sins, our generation is orphaned of scholars, of chachamim, of poskim, and no one wants to paskin on these very delicate matters of agunot. You know, aguna is a very sensitive issue. Because if a woman is married and gets remarried, so then the children are mamzerim. So if you allow a woman to remarry and you know, her husband is still alive, it's a big problem. It's a big problem. So it's not very simple. So there are many who didn't want to get involved. But he says now that there are those who don't want to paskin, right? Due to our many sins, due to Yiridata Dorot, I've taken it upon myself, and I'm going to gird my loins and strengthen myself and try and address this matter, and Hashem should bless me and protect me from error. Save me from error. Okay, so you see that there's emotional intelligence that's involved. You have to feel the pain of the aguna. And you have so many tshuvot of Rav Avadya Yosef and Rav Moshe Feinstein where you see their sensitivity and you see their humanity and you see and feel their pain because they felt the pain of those posing the questions to them. So again, you can have access to all the information and the chatbots can be able to, you know, they already are, but certainly they're going to get better, glean from the entire corpus of Jewish literature, right? The relevant passages in the Talmud and in the Rishonim and in the codes of Jewish law and in the Tshuvot, Rav Avadya and Rav Moshe. But they're missing one thing, Seichel. Because there's a difference between Yediya and Seichel. There's a difference between knowledge and access to information and Seichel. knowing how to apply that information with sensitivity, with seichel, with understanding, with wisdom. And there's something that's known as the fifth chelik of Shulchan Aruch, and that is seichel. The Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, is made of four volumes, but then there's the fifth volume. Right? It's comprised of four volumes, but then there's the fifth volume, and that is seichel. And the earliest source that I could find in print which refers to this fifth chelek of Shulchan Aruch is the Sefer Chut HaMishulash, not to be confused with the Tshuvot Chut HaMishulash. Source number three is the Tshuvot Chut HaMishulash. Source number four is a Sefer called Chut HaMishulash, which provides, it's a beautiful biography of the Chatam Sofer, right? Chut HaMishulash is three, right? Mishulash. So it's a biography of the Chatam Sofer. His father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eger, they were around the same age. Rabbi Akiva Eger, I think, was only 1 year older, but the Chatam Sofer married the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eger, Bezivug Sheni, and the son of the Chatam Sofer, the Ketav Sofer. So it talks about the lives of these three great luminaries, and there, if you take a look at source number four, it's recorded, Ragil Lomar Lanu Vizeh Lashono, how the Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, right, he would regularly tell us the following, and this is his language, right? He's hiru meine Kinder. It's in Yiddish, but if you take a look at the parentheses, it provides the English translation. Be careful, my children, my dear children, ladat, to know that there are arba chalkei shulchan aruch. Hi chachma, aval efshar ladat. Aval bigdei ladat et hachelak hachamishi mishulchan aruch, tzarich siyata dishmaya gdola. There are four sections of the Code of Jewish Law, and you can learn them and understand them. But in order to know the fifth chelak, that requires great siyata dishmaya. And what is the fifth chelak? Lochiach velohorot lefi hador ulefi hamakom vehazman. To be able to prove and to teach and to paskin according to the generation, according to the needs of the generation, and according to the place and time. Likanes, v'lifazer, l'hakel, u'lachmir. When to be strict, when to be lenient. In other words, you need to have that emotional intelligence. You need to have that seichel. You need to understand context. You need to understand the needs of the generation and the needs of the individual. And as great as artificial intelligence is, and these language models and chatbots, again, they might be able to cite you from the four chalakim of the Shulchan Aruch, but they're missing that fifth chalak that is so vital, that fifth chalak, which is seichel, which is to understand the needs of the generation, the needs of the individual. A story is told how a bacher once came to Rav Chaim of Brisk to ask him for smicha, to give him ordination. And Rav Chaim asked him a simple question. Can you name the four chalakim, the four sections of the Shulchan Aruch? Right? So, sure. Sorry, I got that wrong. He asked him to name the five chalakim, the five sections. Or maybe he asked him, what are the sections of the Shulchan Aruch? So the bacher quickly rattled off, you know, Orach Chaim, Yoredeya, Choshen Mishpat, Evan Ha'ezer. But he couldn't name the fifth chelek. So Rav Chaim said, I can't give you smicha. You missed the fifth chelek. Seichel, right? Understanding. That type of emotional intelligence, right? There are so many people that are brilliant, but sometimes they're missing that seichel. Okay. And it's an apocryphal tale, and I've heard it told about other Gedolei Yisrael, but it illustrates the point. There's a famous story of the father of Chaim of Brisk, the Beit HaLevi, that someone once came to him on Erev Pesach and asked if he can fulfill the mitzvah of Arba Kosot, the four cups of wine with four cups of milk. So the Beit HaLevi asked him, are you sick? Are you ill? So the man said, no. And so he began to ask more questions, and he realized that this man had no money for four cups of wine, and that was the nature of this question. So if he couldn't afford four cups of wine and wanted to fulfill the mitzvah with four cups of milk, obviously he didn't have matzah, and obviously he didn't have meat. So according to the story, the Beit HaLevi asked the Rebbetzin to give this man 25 rubles. Okay? So sometimes when someone comes to you with a shaila, you have to unpack that shaila. You have to play a little bit of an armchair psychologist. And sometimes, often, the posek will ask follow-up questions. It's not enough just to ask a question and then get an answer. Right? Oftentimes, I get a question via email or on WhatsApp, and I call and I follow up because it's not so simple. It's not cookie cutter. As I said, psak is personal. It requires emotional intelligence, but it also often requires more information. You need to be able to draw out that information, and at least right now, the chatbot can't do that. The chatbot will just give you some cookie cutter answer without any follow-up questions to get a better sense of the case, to get a better sense of the question. Okay. And there's another apocryphal tale, another story, which I heard. I have yet to find the source for this. If anyone is able to come up with the source, please, either those of you here or those of you watching at home. But I heard at least once that Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was hesitant to paskin over the phone because he wanted to be able to look in the person's eyes, right? So yes, a chatbot may have access to all this information, but it will never be able to sit with the person and understand the struggles that the person is going through, get a better sense of the case, of the scenario, look into the person's eyes. You need that humanity. You need that emotional intelligence. Another thing that you need is divine assistance. And if you take a look here at source number 5, the Torah instructs us to listen to the rabbis. Al pi haTorah asher yorucha ve'al hamishpat asher yomru lecha ta'aseh lo tasur min hadavar asher yagidu lecha yamin u'smol. We're not supposed to deviate, not permitted to deviate from what they tell us, either to the right or to the left. And Chazal say, afilu im omer lecha al yamin shu smol, even if they tell you that right is left, and even if they tell you that left is right, even if it's not logical to you, even if it doesn't make sense to you, we have emunat chachamim. This is the authority that Chazal have, and we're supposed to listen to them. We have a mitzvah min haTorah to listen to the rabbis. Okay? Kal vachomer if they tell you that right is right and left is left, meaning if it is logical, if it does make sense. So there, the Ramban, here in source number 6, in his comments there, he says something very striking. The reason why we have a mitzvah to listen to the rabbis, and the reason why maybe the rabbis sit, the seat of the Sanhedrin was in the Beit HaMikdash, is because the rabbis are privy to siyata dishmaya, to divine assistance, when they issue their rulings. And take a look where I've underlined here in source number 6. Ki al hadat shelahem, hu noten lahem haTorah. For through their wisdom and knowledge, really, through their knowledge, Hashem gives the Torah. Afilu yabeinecha kimachlif hayamin bismol. Even if it seems to you as if they've confused right with left. The kol shekin sheish lecha lachshov shehem omrim al yamin shu yamin. And certainly if it is logical, if they tell you right is right and left is left. Why? This next line is crucial. Ki ruach Hashem al mishart because the Spirit of God rests on those who minister in His temple. As I said, the seat of the Sanhedrin was in the Beit HaMikdash, right? And actually the context there in Parshat Shoftim, it says when you have a question, you're going to go up there and ask of the Kohanim, the Levim, you're going to go to the place where I have chosen. That, of course, is an allusion to Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash. So the Spirit of God rests on those who minister in his sanctuary, in his holy temple, v'lo yazov et chasidav, and he does not leave his righteous. La'olam nishmiru min ha'ta'ut u'min ha'michshol. He will always protect them. They will always be protected from error and from stumbling block. Okay, so there is an element of siyata dishmaya, which I don't know that artificial intelligence, as intelligent as it is, can have. Okay? And you have other examples of this as well. Here, there's a Gemara in Ketubot, Andaf Samech, which seems to suggest that a posek is privy to siyata deshmaya, receives divine assistance. Amar Abaye, hai milta damo rabbanan. Abaye makes a statement from the rabbis that even concerning something like eating an egg in kutach. An egg, we know what it is. Kutach was this dairy dip that they used to make from soured milk, and there are questions in the Talmud in terms of what blessing do you make on it, and can you eat, let's say, a fish that was hot on a meat plate, can you eat it with this dairy dip called kutach? So, lo lishrei inish b'makom rabbe, a person should not issue a ruling in front of his rabbi, as the Talmud says in many places, even if it's something very simple, like can you eat an egg together with kutach? Lo mishum demechse ke'af kiruta, not only because it looks like it's hefker, meaning it's disrespectful, it's inappropriate to issue a ruling in front of your rebbe, but ele mishum delo mistaya milta lememra. And the way many understand this line here in the Gemara is that because if you do so, you will not benefit from divine assistance, that siyua, that siyata dishmaya, that a posek gets if he has the right intentions. And here's another example of that here in source number 8. The Gemara in Sota on Daf Dalet is discussing the shiur of stira. If a woman is suspected of being a sota, of being an adulteress, so the Talmud calculates and tries to define how much time she has to be alone with a man who's not her husband, during the course of which time they can be intimate. In other words, how long does the marital act take? So the Gemara offers a number of suggestions on how quick, or how many minutes, how long the marital act could take, what the shiur of stira is. And one of those who offers a suggestion is Ben Azai. So the Gemara there, here in source number 8 at the top of the page, says, but wait a minute. Ve'ika ben Azai delo nasiv. Ben Azai wasn't married. In other words, how would he know? He wasn't married. Right? So then the Gemara says, well, maybe he was married and then got divorced. And the Gemara says, or maybe he learned it from his Rebbe. He had a tradition from his rabbi, what the shiur of stira is. And look where I've underlined. And then the Gemara offers another suggestion. V'bayit ema, or if you prefer, sod Hashem lireyav. The Gemara here brings the pasuk from Tehillim to suggest that the secrets of God are revealed to those who fear him. In other words, the posek receives divine assistance. Source number 9 is an excerpt from a tshuva of the Chatam Sofer, Chelek Bet, Yeridei HaSimon Tzadi Dalet, and it's a wonderful story that Mori VeRebbe, my rabbi and mentor of Moshe David Tendler Zatzal, was very fond of repeating the story, and Dr. Berzon, perhaps you heard Rav Tendler share the story. The story goes as follows. Uvda Yadana, known story, a known incident, be Frankfurt de Main, Parach Tarnagolet, Litoch Kalachat, Chemah Rotachat al Ha'esh, Umeta, Betocho. That's the scenario. There was a chicken, a hen, that flew and landed in a large vat of boiling butter, which was on the fire. Okay, so they posed the question to the rabbi, and the way Rav Tendler always shared the story was it was the new rabbi. They had just hired him. It doesn't say that here, but okay, that's the way Rav Tendler would share the story. And so they asked the rabbi, what do we do? Can we sell this butter to Gentiles, right? Can we get some hana'ah from it? Because, either this was maybe a factory, or this was for commercial purposes, or, back then you wouldn't want to waste all this good butter. Right? Whatever the scenario exactly was, it's not clear from the tshuva, but the rabbi rules that the butter is prohibited and you can't get any hana'ah from it. Why? Because of basar b'chalav, meat and milk. Right? One of the isurim of meat and milk is that if they are cooked together, you can't derive any benefit from it. Okay. Except that that's not the right answer. So, Toch kidei dibur, the tshuva says, the way Chatam Sofer relates the story, is that he immediately said, no, I'm sorry. It's not because of basar b'chalav. It's asur, why? Because of ever min hachai. This was a live animal that died inside of a boiling vat of butter. So it's Aver Min HaChai. So his conclusion was correct in that even a Gentile may not benefit from it, and you can't sell this butter to a Gentile. So the conclusion was correct, but his initial Sfara was incorrect. And for the Chatam Sofer, this proves that, and he cites a pasuk from Mishlei and a pasuk from Kohelet, and he kind of, puts the two pasukim together. But the pasuk from Kohelet, he writes, Kishigiga sheyotze milifnei hashalit, when an error comes forth, is issued by a ruler, right? And then the pasuk in Mishlei says that lo yeuneh latzadik kol aven. No harm befalls the righteous. And he brings these two psukim together, he lumps them together to say that if the posek has fear of Hashem and he does his best, even though maybe his initial svarot were incorrect, but you see that his maskana, the conclusion, his final psak indeed was correct. Hashem protected him from embarrassment. So, again, a chatbot may have access to all this information, the entire corpus of Jewish literature, but does it have siyata d'shmaya? And even as these language models continue to learn, I don't know. I don't know if it really merits siyata d'shmaya. And the last thing, which I think a posek must have and is so crucial to psak halacha, that is masora. That is masoret or masora, a chain of tradition. Okay. And here in source number 10, this is a famous midrash, and this is scattered throughout Chazal, this idea that gadol shimusha yoter milemuda. Serving a rabbi is greater than learning from the rabbi. Okay, being his assistant, following him around, you learn so much. I can tell you how many hours and hours I spent learning from Mori Verebi, both in the classroom and out of the classroom. Rav Tendler, very generous with his time, would take me into his office in Reuben Hall at Yeshiva University, down in the basement by the biology lab, and also his private study in his home, his personal library, where he would answer calls, he would listen to his messages, he would have a whole host of messages on the most sophisticated and sensitive and delicate areas of halacha, and he would return those calls, and often he would allow me to listen in on the conversation in order to learn. And just from one's Rebbe's behavior, one can learn so much. One can learn, you know, piles and heaps of halachot. So the Medrash here is speaking about Yehoshua ben Nun. He's referred to as Mesharet Moshe. Why is Yehoshua chosen to be Moshe's successor? Well, as Chazal tell us, because he was dole umashke, he drew from the water, from the wellsprings of his Rebbe, and, you know, lo yamush mitocha ohel, he never left the tent. He was always there in Moshe's tent, always learning. And so the Medrash here says, Gadol Shimusha Yoter Milemuda, in relation to Yehoshua bin Nun. So you need a Rebbe. And there's a concept in the Gemara, in Sanhedrin, of a Gamir and Savir. Now the Mishnah at the beginning of Sanhedrin says that Dine Mamenot, monetary matters, are adjudicated Bishlosha, by three people, three Dayanim. Right? Something that we're all familiar with. But then the Gemara here in source number 11 on Daf Hey discusses whether an individual who is a mumche l'rabim, an exceptional individual who's an expert, echad ha-mumche l'rabim, if he can adjudicate by himself. Okay, so that is the context here. The Gemara says, v'im haya mumche l'rabim, dan afilu yechide. Normally we say that Dine Mamenot Bishlosha, but if he's a Mumche L'Rabim, he can adjudicate by himself. So both Rav Nachman and Rav Chia said, yeah, like me. What do you mean, like me? Right? What does it mean, like me? Rav Nachman says, like me. And the Gemara explains, and Rabbi Chia says, like me, I adjudicated by myself. Right? I ruled on monetary matters alone. So the Gemara explains what that means is, like me, I'm a gamir and a savir. De gamirna v'savirna v'nakitna rishuta. And I got rishut from the Reish Galuta, the exilarch. Okay. So what does it mean, gamir v'samir? So take a look at Rashi. Gamir, Rashi says, shmuot dinin merabotai. What does it mean, I am a gamir? Gamir means I've received a tradition. In fact, the word gemara means just that, tradition. It's a recording of those traditions that were received and were recorded as to how to interpret the Mishnah, our Torah Sheba'al Peh. So a gamir is one who has learned from his rabbis. But what is a savir? So Rashi says, Yodea ani lehosif v'leyashev ta'amim mida'ati. Oh. The savir is someone who can also extrapolate. Someone who has learned, but then someone who is able to add and to answer based on his own intuition, based on his own instinct. And I gave you a few examples here of how Rashi, Rabban Shel Yisrael, did just that in a number of places. The Torah tells us to make an ephod for the Kohen Gadol, this vest. It's one of the vestments of the Kohen Gadol. And the Torah doesn't exactly tell us what that ephod or apron, I called it a vest, I'll explain why in a moment, doesn't exactly tell us what that ephod should look like. We know we have to attach it to the breastplate. We know it has to be made with certain materials, but as far as its design, right, we don't exactly know what the ephod looks like. And it's also absent from all of Safrut Chazal, all of rabbinic literature. It doesn't really relate to how the ephod was supposed to be constructed. And that's why, if you look at the pictures of the Machon HaMikdash, Rashi has his ephod, looks like an apron that's worn around the back. We'll look at Rashi in a moment. Okay? And the Rambam has it, I said, a vest. It's more like a vest that the choshen, the breastplate, is attached to. It almost reminds me, the ephod of the Rambam almost reminds me of the protective gear that professional football players, American football, wear, right? It has, like, you know, kind of shoulder pads, and it's, like, worn around the chest. Okay, if you take a look at the illustrations that the Machon HaMikdash has rendered and made. And there's a reason for that discrepancy, and the reason is because in Chazal there is no clear definition of how the ephod is supposed to be constructed, what it's supposed to look like. We know the materials, we have a sense of what it's supposed to be attached to, but as far as its shape, we don't know. So Rashi, in his comments to Parashat Tetzaveh, here in source number 14, he writes the following: Lo shamati velo matzati bivraita perush tavnito. I haven't found in Chazal, right now, neither in a braita nor have I heard, maybe he means from his rebbeim, exactly how the ephod should be constructed. However, v'libi omer li, my heart tells me, and this is key, libi omer li shul chagur lo me'achorav. It was like this sinar, he writes, an apron that was worn around the back and worn by these aristocratic women while they ride horseback. Okay, so you can imagine what that would look like. Now, how did Rashi know that? How did he? So there's this apocryphal tale that Rashi was struggling to explain what the ephod looked like and how it should be constructed. Again, he says, I haven't found a source in Chazal, and I didn't hear it from my rabbis, but my heart tells me it looked like this. So there's an apocryphal tale that he was sweating over this question and struggling, and all of a sudden, in front of his eyes, there is a woman, an aristocratic woman, a royal woman, whatever, passing by on horseback, wearing this apron, and, oh, Nafalo Asimon, light bulb goes off, and he says, that must be what the ephod looked like. Yeah, that's a nice story, but it's hard to imagine. But I think what Rashi here is saying when he says, Libi Omerli, my heart tells me, in other words, based on all that I've learned and all that I've absorbed, this is what I believe the correct answer is, even though I don't have a clear source in Chazal. And he writes something very similar in a tshuva here in source number 13. In the tshuvot of Rashi, Simon Nuntet, Rashi didn't only write a commentary to Tanakh and to the Talmud, but Rashi was also a posek, and we have the tshuvot of Rashi. And this is concerning a big controversy back then in Worms concerning the lungs of an animal. And he writes there too, that I haven't been able to find a source in Chazal to answer this question. And I didn't hear this answer from my Rebbe, Rebbe Yaakov ben Yakar, who is Rashi's primary teacher. And he writes where I've underlined, V'amnam aninit lebi lan gadol Rebbe Yaakov bar Yakar. But nevertheless, I'm going to hang my answer on this great tree, my Rebbe, Rebbe Yaakov ben Yakar. V'af kilo shamati mipiv davar zeh. And even though I did not hear this from his mouth, I did not hear this issuing from his mouth, mikoma kom libi usvarati v'avanati mipiv yatzu. Nevertheless, through my heart and my intellect and my mind and my understanding, this is what I believe would have issued forth. It's as if I had heard it from him. In other words, even though I don't have a clear source in Chazal, and even though I didn't learn this from my Rebbeim, based on my knowledge of Torah, based on my understanding, this is what I believe the correct answer to be. And again, while a chatbot may have access to the entire corpus of Jewish literature, it's missing that Masorah, it's missing that chain of tradition, which is so crucial, so vital in rendering Psak Halacha. So will artificial intelligence replace rabbis? I asked ChatGPT this very question. And if you take a look at the very bottom here of the second page and on the back side, I was happy to see that the chatbot itself came to some of the very conclusions that I had in preparing this before I even asked this question to ChatGPT. And ChatGPT writes the following: artificial intelligence has the potential to impact various fields, including religion and spirituality. While AI technology can automate certain tasks and provide information, it is unlikely to completely replace rabbis and other religious leaders. I like the word completely. Partially maybe, but not completely. Here are a few reasons why. And then you could read this for yourself, but number one, human connection. Okay. So again, we said that psak is personal. You need that emotional intelligence, that EQ, that emotional quotient. Number two, interpretation and context, right? That's also crucial, as we said. Ethical considerations. Number four, community leadership. We didn't speak about community. I wouldn't imagine that the chatbot would somehow become the Rav of the Kehila and the leader of the community, but as far as answering questions, I think it's certainly very lacking for the reasons why I explained this morning. And look at the bottom. However, it is worth noting that AI may have a supportive role in religious contexts. For example, it can assist rabbis by providing access to vast amounts of information, facilitating language translation, or helping with administrative tasks. AI may also contribute to the study of religious texts, enabling scholars to analyze and interpret texts more efficiently. In summary, while AI may have a growing presence in various aspects of our lives, the role of rabbis and religious leaders is deeply rooted in human connection, interpretation, ethics, and community leadership, which are aspects that AI is unlikely to replace entirely. Again, sticks in the word entirely. So we have a little to be worried about, but artificial intelligence won't replace us rabbis entirely or completely. Baruch Hashem, we are safe. We have job security. It may change its mind, or as it continues to learn, that is true. But I think this last point is important. That, and I think this is the way we should approach technology bichlal. And this is certainly the approach of many great Gedolei Yisrael, many great poskim, including Mori v'Rebbe Rav Tendler Zatzal. That instead of fearing advancements in technology and the sciences and medicine and the questions and concerns that they pose and the ethical dilemmas that they raise, instead of fearing those questions, you know, our Torah, as I said when we began this series, it's not some old tome that sits on the shelf and gathers dust. It's a Torah Chaim, a living, breathing tradition which engages the modern world and confronts its challenges. So we have to be willing to learn about these things and roll up our sleeves and ask these questions. Instead of running away in fear, you can view artificial intelligence and these chatbots as a powerful tool which will ultimately, as ChatGPT itself said, aid in the study of Torah. Right? You can be fearful that what does this mean for psak halacha? People are going to ask their questions of halacha to a chatbot, to artificial intelligence. That's so dangerous. On the other hand, maybe this will be a powerful tool to aid in Torah study. And it reminds me of a statement that's attributed to the Chafetz Chaim, and we'll end with this. When the Chafetz Chaim was asked about the camera, you know, the Chafetz Chaim lived at the time when all of a sudden you had cameras, and he was asked about the appearance of the camera, this new invention, and he said, now we will be able to truly understand the meaning of the Mishnah in Masechet Avot, which tells us if you consider and look towards three things, you will not be tempted into sin. You will stray away from Aveira, right? Know what is above you. Da mala mala mimcha. Ayin ro'ah. There's always an eye that sees. The ozen shomat, an ear that hears. V'chol ma'asecha b'sefer nichtavin. And all of your deeds, all of your actions are recorded in a book. So, at the time of the Chafetz Chaim, all of a sudden, with the appearance of cameras, now we can understand what this Mishnah means when it says that there's always an eye that's watching. Certainly, all the more so today with cameras everywhere. Now everyone has a camera in their pocket. There's always an eye watching. You have to be careful how you act. You have to be careful how you behave, right? And there's always an ear that's listening, right? Things are constantly being recorded. And things are always being recorded in a book. Right now, things are forever on social media and on the internet. You have to tell your children and grandchildren, be careful what you post online. These things will be there for years to come. They are preserved for posterity. So again, instead of fearing artificial intelligence, I think ultimately we can embrace it along with all of these other wonderful advancements in technology and use it to aid us in the study of Torah and in our relationship with Hashem. Thank you.